Hello and welcome to Architecturist Design in Mind. We here at Architecture are passionate about design, so we wanted to sit down with whom we believe are some of the most important designers and design thinkers today. Here, we're in conversation with Paolo Antonelli.
Everything is designed. Sometimes it's designed badly, other times it's designed really well, and most times it's designed in an unmemorable way.
Paolo Antonelli has been senior curator of art and design at the MoMA since 1994. In that time, she's seen the revolution design has gone through and has presented it through some of the most dynamic exhibitions in the world. Born in Sardinia and raised in Milan, Antonelli's parents were two doctors, and she was headed down the path of economics when she realized that wasn't what she was meant to do and decided to study architecture at the Polytechnic Institute in Milan. Her mentor at the school was also interested in philosophy and introduced her to that. She believes music further taught her English language. After graduating, she began teaching at UCLA and found an ad for the curator position at MoMA. She applied and she got it. Over the past decades, Antonelli has mounted some of the museum's most captivating shows, including the infamous Design and the Elastic Mind. In this interview, we speak about her mentors, our default fonts, and the acquisition of the at symbol. We spoke in her office at the Museum of Modern Art, overlooking a bustling New York City.
Objects are hooks for me, and that's how I go through life. Everything is a door that opens into either my personal memory or into like a daydream of where the object was designed and who did the molding and the kind of the injection molding. I just go into this whole, daydreaming, truly.
Fantasy.
So that's what I like to share with people, and that's why I became a curator. But I see immediately that people connect with things. There's no distance, there's no high and low anymore. You don't have to come to the museum to take your vitamins of high art. You can just come to recognize yourself in the objects that are on the shelves, which is the best.
I'd be curious to know what was an object from your childhood.
An object from my childhood? Well, the Slinky, for instance. Yes. I remember when my father brought a Slinky home. But, you know, there are so many objects that are in this museum that were part of my childhood. We used to call it Mangiadischi, which means record eater. It's one of those gramophones by Mario Bellini, the orange one that you put the record in the mouth. So I grew up with that. What else did I grow up with? Well, all of the Castiglioni furniture, or the Italian, or the Gio Colombo little plastic cart with all the drawers. I still have it in my home. Not to mention the beanbag chair, which is, as you can see, because you almost like tripped on it. I live with beanbag chairs that are just like lying down like cows on the floor. So many. It's not funny. You know, just really many.
And are there beanbag chairs in your house?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Only one, because I don't have such a big house. But even in that case, my house is not high design. I mean, it is high design. Doesn't look like a museum at all. But that's because one uses the high design, right? Design is the one that fits the best in your life.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I mean, when I think about that, well, first of all, I interviewed Mario Bellini a few months ago, and it's great to hear he's such a legend. I mean, to think that.
But does he talk about design? Because he kind of reneged design to move into architecture
and furniture,
which kills me.
Yeah,
I know, right? Because he was just the best product designer, but he's almost abdicated that part of his career. Did he tell you about the projects or about the objects?
Only about his very, you know, only because I asked him about his history.
See? It's so funny. Anyway, what can you do?
I wonder why that is. I wonder why he turned away. It's interesting because you were saying how you turned away from furniture because you didn't feel like it advanced enough.
Well, yeah, but that's different. I'm a curator. I feel that in his case, it was a matter of stature. I think that he perceived architecture to be higher than design, and therefore he wanted to kind of cancel the word industrial designer from his official title and always have architect.
It might be because, you know, there's this, it might be a size issue.
Yeah. I agree. I agree. What can I say? You said it, not me.
So your house isn't filled with like design objects?
I mean, yes, it is, but not with any kind of pretension. I mean, it ranges, the objects range from an extensible table that I bought at the liquidation sale of the Dorset Hotel before we tore it down on 54th Street. It was like $60. And then I have a chair, one of the chairs by Hella Jongerius that is so beautiful because she gave it to me and she's like my sister. We were born 2 weeks apart.
And, oh, really? Same year.
And her birthday was 2 days ago.
And your birthday is coming up.
And my birthday was 15 days ago. No,
happy
17
birthday.
Days ago.
Happy
Thank you
birthday.
Very much. And so I have an Arco lamp. I have an Ingo Maurer lamp. I have all these objects, but because they're great to live with. It's not a mausoleum at all.
Well, you know, I think that's what can be so enriching about design. It really, like, it enriches your simple daily activities.
Absolutely. It enriches them or it deprives them, you know, mm-hmm. because when it's bad, it's really bad. And that's why I consider my job and the job of other curators like me almost like a social mission. We're here to help people sharpen their own critical tools so that they can recognize bad design when it's in front of them and reject it, either by not buying it or by protesting, whatever it needs, whatever it takes. So it's about rejecting not only environmental irresponsibility, not only high prices, not only bad labor practices. It's also about rejecting ugliness and laziness. I believe that beauty is a form of respect. And when I say beauty, I mean formal elegance. It can be punk beauty. It doesn't have to be like prettiness. But I think that showing effort in the formal aspects of a design is a way to show respect towards other human beings. So there's no need to accept sloppy leaf shaped and formed objects, including websites, including, you know, ATM screens and all sorts of design.
The feeling that I get when I interact with something that's beautifully designed, even if it's as simple as, you know, something on my iPhone, is so much better than when I'm working with something that hasn't been really thought through. Yet you go into people's houses all the time and you can see that they've just kind of thrown things in there that work, not that give them a sense of, you know, beauty or satisfaction.
Well, they could do better for the same amount of money with all other variables being constant. They could do better if they knew that they have the choice. You know what I'm saying? If they knew that it's in their power to do better. So sometimes it's just about lifting the veil and showing people what the standards are. And I have to say that the baselines that have been created by companies right now that are much more design conscious is a boon. You know, of course, the cliche is to say that Apple elevated. And it's true. Much as I don't like to praise Apple particularly, especially lately, I have to say what Jobs has done and what the company has done is tremendous when it comes to letting people know that they could have beautifully designed objects. But it's not only them. It's also the websites. It's also the screens of so many apps. There's much more design consciousness right now, and I love it. I love it because I think that people will, in the end, become much more demanding, which is all we need to be, demanding.
Mm-hmm. And curious.
And curious, of course, yes.
Mm-hmm. Sometimes I'll be working on just like a really short edit on a tiny paragraph, but I'll change the font anyways just so that I can enjoy it more.
Oh, my God. I find that lighting in the house and fonts when you write are the hardest thing, and they can change everything.
They really can. I'm always adjusting the lighting to make it
what is
just
your
right.
Font? What is your favorite font?
Well, my standard favorite, I mean, that's a difficult question because there's so many great ones. My standard right now is Avenir, which
Avenir.
Is just the simple on the computer, just the simple one.
But that's kind of like it shows a certain attitude. I'm
really?
Very blunt. I'm Arial.
See, I'm not an aerial person.
No?
No, I'm not. It's interesting. I'm not an aerial person. Mm. Although I feel like Arial is the journalist font.
Ah. Yeah, it's the most neutral to me. It's much more neutral than Verdana or than Helvetica. Arial mm-hmm. is the one that doesn't interfere with my thoughts. And it's similar to me to music. I can never listen to music while I'm doing something else. Because I get distracted. I focus on the music. So music is a thing. And the same thing with font. If I choose a font like Avenir, then I cannot read the text anymore. It's very fun. But then other people use a font and I'm like, oh my God, look at that. I should use that font. And the same thing, I go to people's homes and I'm like, oh, they have like lights in the ceiling and I would never do it and it looks so good. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's the same.
It's very particular, lights in the ceiling. It has to be done just right. Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, sometimes I'll walk by an apartment and I'll see that they'll only have the lights on in the ceilings and I think to myself, don't you just want to have a little light somewhere, something to make it warmer?
I never do light in the ceiling. Never.
Yeah.
They always have light points falling down on your knees. You cannot read anything.
Exactly.
It's just, I do everything wrong when it comes to fonts and lights. Disaster.
Mm-hmm. But talking about fonts, I was, I was so impressed by the notion of acquiring the at symbol.
Oh, thank you.
And,
I'm proud of it.
Mm-mm. So I would have never thought of that as something that a design that you would acquire for a museum. Can you just talk about that a bit?
Yeah, I don't remember how it happened. I really don't have eureka moments, and I don't remember anything. but I remember that I started thinking about it for the collection, and then I started researching it. And the more I researched it, the more I was thinking, oh my God, this stands for everything I believe in. It stands for the old meeting the new. It stands with the timeless for this timelessness of modern. It stands for the idea of identity. It stands for bringing the shared economy into the museum. I cannot even acquire it because it's public domain. I can only anoint it. I mean, it was just really one after the other. It just checked all the different the boxes. So it just made me really happy. I started thinking about it, and it took me a long time to acquire it because some of my colleagues were very resistant. You probably have realized there's something really huge going on in the world, and because of that also in the world of design, when it comes to the junction of the digital and the physical world, so the material and the immaterial world. And there are so many people that still believe that RL, real life, is a juxtaposition, is other than digital life. And instead, we know very well that they're the same, one and the same at this point. But this rigidity of wanting to consider reality only what is not in the digital world carries also into the museum sometimes. Mm-hmm. And so it was really, really hard to convince some of the internal people. It was not even the acquisitions committee or the fact that this acquisition could happen. And when I brought it to the acquisitions committee, it was instead voted in. And it was fabulous. I remember I was going to San Francisco I was going to be at a conference in Berkeley, I think it was. And I remember at that time, I still had my BlackBerry, it was several years ago. I had prepared, in the taxi to the airport, I had prepared about 23 emails that I was going to send to the press that I knew announcing the acquisition, and I had a blog post already, so I was waiting for the blog to post on the MoMA blog, and then I was going to hit send. And I hit send basically 10 minutes before getting on the plane. There was no internet on the plane at that time. I landed in San Francisco. I had BBC interview requests, and I'm like, oh my God.
Yeah.
It was really quite fantastic.
Yeah, sure.
It really, because it made so much sense, even though it might not seem that way.
Well, I mean, I think it's just such a radical proposition. It's true. It seemed, when I read that, I thought, gosh, I mean, there are so many, at so many levels, and one, I'd like to better understand what you mean by the old meeting the new. But A, to acquire something that is not tangible, mm-hmm. you know, that's a big deal.
But that we had done before. I mean, acquiring something not tangible was was big, but not as big as the idea of acquiring something that cannot be acquired, something that is in the public domain, you know, mm-hmm. the idea of anointing instead of acquiring. So,
and what does that mean? What does
well,
it mean?
Well, in the past, having a museum meant having objects that were either unique or very rare and caring for them, curating them, you know, so curare means really taking care. Mm. And that, if you wish, was already kind of put in trouble by the Industrial Revolution and the idea of design. I mean, you had serial objects even before, but there was a sense of caring. When you have design, you know, you break one, you make, and you put in another. But in the case of the at sign, there was not even an idea of ownership. You didn't even have to buy it. You couldn't reserve the rights. You know, when people call us here at MoMA, like they do for other objects in the collection, and they ask us for images to print in books, etc., we tell them, it's on your keyboard, just push the button. And they're like, excuse me? I say, yeah, I mean, we recommend you use American typewriter because it's the closest to similar font to the one that was used by Ray Tomlinson in 1972, but you could just push the button, you know, so it's a completely different mm-hmm. sense. So in that way, as curators, we're not anymore care for objects, possessors, but rather we are guides that prepare checklists of excellent case studies that can serve as paragons for people going about their business and their lives so that they can feel what good design is. All right, so if an object cannot be had, cannot be possessed, because either it's in the public domain or it's too big, like the 747, then we can do a virtual acquisition. But regarding the old and the new, the reason why I was saying that is mm-hmm. because the first known instance of an at sign goes back to the monks that were hand copying manuscripts. And it was a way to abbreviate the Latin preposition ad, A-D, which meant in direction of or in relationship with. So it had the same meaning in the Middle Ages. And it was used to collapse. In that case, it was only two letters. In the case of the email, it's a bigger line of code. But still, it was a synthesis of a preposition or a code that would put two terms in relationship. So it's the same thing.
Fascinating.
I know, isn't it?
It's really fascinating. Mm-hmm. It really is something I wouldn't have never known.
Me neither. I don't know. I don't remember how it all started, but then I started. And also, you know, Ray Tomlinson just died a few months ago. He was the engineer that was at BBN, the company that had been contracted by the government of the United States to develop the internet, and he was in charge of the email program. So he adopted the sign. It was on the keyboard because it had been used through the centuries in this kind of accounting way to put relationship and ratios together. And he saw it there, and he was looking for a way to abbreviate the code that would connect the name of the person to the name of the computer to locate the person. And so he did some research, found out what it meant, and adopted it. And the first email that he sent was about the use of the at sign. So,
wow.
I know, it's really quite amazing how everything fit.
It's also incredible, something we use every day, the depth and history that that comes with it that we just don't know about.
But that's why design moves me every single day, because the things that populate our lives, like little beings that are older than we are and that really we couldn't do without, really move me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're moving. They are amazing masterpieces.
It sounds like the other reason it moves you is because people feel so connected to these things.
Well, people feel
they connected. Trigger such memories, and
they definitely do. But also, it's the human labor, intellect, enthusiasm, passion that went into them. Oh my God! I mean, when you start looking inside objects and you use them like doors, there's such passion and there's such history. That's why, I mean, design to me is so higher than any art. You know, it really is a symbol of the love that we have for other human beings.
It's a beautiful way of saying it.
Thank you.
You really are.
I love design. Yes. I love design very much.
Mm-hmm. When did you start falling in love with it?
You know, I cannot even
pinpoint.
I grew up in Milan, so before falling into the design profession, I went through economics, did some journalism, I studied architecture, but I was lucky because I fell exactly where I needed to fall.
Yeah, I mean, it was interesting to read about that history and how you had volunteered to for that. Was it a festival? It was $15 a week.
Oh yeah. It was the installation of an exhibition at the Triennale. Mm-hmm.
But you did well enough that
I didn't volunteer. I got hired.
Yes,
$15 a week.
I'm so sorry. Mm-hmm. You volunteered to get hired.
Yes,
I meant to say
exactly.
and that you must have done well enough that the editor of Domus said, "Come on."
Yeah, I kind of screamed at him one day. That's why I think he hired me. You know the story?
Yeah, I read about it.
Yeah, because his wife, he was the deputy editor under Bellini, by the way.
Amazing.
Bellini was the editor and Vittorio Magnago was the deputy editor, and his wife Marlene was 7 months pregnant. She was going around with this gigantic belly and doing all the work, and he was never there because he was at Domus being a deputy editor. So I remember one day, you know, Marlene felt almost like dizzy and she had to sit down, and I got so angry. So I picked up the phone. I said, "Can I please speak?" I called Domus and I asked to speak with Victoria. I said, "Your wife is not feeling well. She's 7 months pregnant. You're the curator in charge. So would you please come and tell us what we're supposed to do?"
That's great.
And so
the spirit of 18, 19-year-old.
Yeah, whatever.
Whatever.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah. So then he hired me. Yeah, even in that case.
He was like, "This is. We need this woman on our team."
Yeah, I think I $18 a week at that point. Yes, mm-hmm. It was great.
Well,
I was rich.
It's not about the money. I mean, look, it opened up your whole.
Of course. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It opened everything.
Was he? Would you say he's one of your mentors?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I never really, when I think of mentors, I think of people that taught me also how to live, not only how to work. In the case of Vittorio, he was fantastic and gave me my chance. My mentors, the people that I think of my mentors are four, and unfortunately only one is a woman, so I'll start with her. Sarah Little Turnbull, she just recently passed away, and she was like 98. She was a woman like this tall, and I'm making the gesture of like getting to half my chest, and fierce, really fierce. She used to be an editor at House Beautiful in New York City in the 1940s and 50s. At that time, she was dating Gordon Parks, so they would go to the Whitney because that was the only place where an interracial couple could have lunch and not be looked at in a funny way. That's what she told me. And she was just like the most glamorous, like this tall, but she would have her suits made, her dresses made by Givenchy, you know, custom made. She was just hilarious. We met in San Francisco because we liked each other's hat at a gallery opening. And at that time, she had her own lab at Stanford University Business School. And in the business school, all the doors would be brown, but hers would be red. And she was doing,
great.
You know, she was fantastic.
That's
she was doing anthropological research for design before people even knew that anthropology could be a boon for design. Mm. So she was studying this, and she was fantastic. Then my other big mentor was Giulio Castelli, who was the founder of Cartel, the plastic furniture manufacturing company. Amazing person. Who taught me, of course, how to work, but also how to deal with everybody, how to learn from the craftspeople in the factory and the line factory workers, how to make things. And also he taught me how to have a marriage that lasts 7 years. You know, it was just amazing, like the way he lived. It was just the flair. Another person was...
Well, let's just quickly talk about that.
Yes.
The marriage bit and just... You were saying you taught you how to communicate with people that you're working with. Is that
yes,
something?
Yes, yes.
What's the advice there?
Well, the secret of Italian design that I learned from him is that designers are great, but manufacturers are responsible for the greatness of an object, mm-hmm. almost as much as the designers. So With him, with Giulio, I did a book that was a book only on Italian furniture manufacturers. We went around and interviewed them all. But the secret of Italian design was exactly that, the fact that the architects, designers spoke dialect and spoke on an even ground and an even level with the factory workers and the craftspeople. So there was parity of importance. The mm-hmm. architect was not more important than the cabinet maker. So that's the beauty. And it was a transfer of knowledge and a collaboration that was really, really deep.
We have a Tufty Too by Patricia Urquiola. You know, and I was thinking about, okay, so she designed it, but this has been handmade in Italy over 4 months. I mean, these are the people that are really putting that design, bringing that design to fruition.
Absolutely.
So it's a complete collaboration.
It's a complete collaboration, and these people are proud of what they do, and they would be offended if Patricia gave them too precise of a drawing. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. They have to sit there, and Patricia has to do the sketch, and then it's all about working together. Mm-hmm. And that's really the beauty of it. And that's what so many countries are afraid of losing, especially Italy.
Mm-hmm. And how about the marriage bit?
Marriage bit. What? I have a touch wood. It's already 20 years for mine. So, I mean, we're not married, but we've been together for 20 years. So I consider it a marriage. So, I think I'm tackling Giulio pretty well. He has 50 years on me, but no biggie. I'm going to get there.
70. It's incredible.
I know. Can you imagine?
Amazing. Mm-hmm. It's beautiful. It speaks to also having had a long life.
Yeah, he had a very long life. He died when he was, actually it was not 70, a little less than 70, because he died at 86 and they had been together since they were 18. So,
wow.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And then your third?
My third.
Mentor.
Oh, mentor, yes. I'm like, my third what? I don't have a
husband?
Third husband. Yeah, right.
I'm sticking with one.
Italo Lupi, who was the art director of Domus, then became the editor-in-chief of Abitare, and I went with him, and then now he's still a graphic designer. He's not really that active in publishing anymore, mm-hmm. but even in that case, he taught me about work ethics. He taught me about relationship with people from all over the world and how to be really collegial with other people. So it's always more than just working.
Yet you have such a, I mean, I think about, you know, being in New York and life-work balance. How do you manage that?
Yeah, I decided not to have children next life. You know, you cannot have children in New York. I don't know how they do it. You know, it's like I used to see these mothers with the child, the stroller, hailing cabs with their feet and signing up kids for high school when they were in their crib. I mean, I just didn't want to do it. My parents are in Milan, so I couldn't have had them help. And I couldn't even fathom the education system here. I was too terrified.
Do they have grandchildren?
Yeah, yeah. My sister, thank God, has two children.
Great.
She lives in Florence. So,
Florence.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
What a beautiful place to live. Mm-hmm.
Milan is better, but Florence is pretty too.
You're proud of Milan?
Well, yeah, my parents are in Milan. I just came back. I was in both Florence and Milan, you know, so I could see it. Mm-mm.
You know, you mentioned some of your mentors and one of them being a woman. And before we were turning the mic on, we were talking about people I've interviewed in design and all we hear is male names. What's that about?
Well, there are very many different reasons. I do a lot of public programs, and I have encountered what other people have said, that women tend to say no more often. But I've also
Oh, interesting. Women tend to say...
Yeah, I can tell you. I do these programs almost once a month, and one time I went through 7 women artists before one said yes. And the no's were related to not being available or not feeling comfortable speaking in public. I mean, it really is that way.
Yeah.
But then I remember I did one public program. I do these salons for R&D salons, they're called, and it was about conferences. It was called Conferences, Conferences, Conferences. And it was 4 female plus me, so 5 women speakers. But one of the speakers said, there's nobody that is African-American here, which is bad. And so we started having this public conversation. It was fantastic. And she completely convinced me. Women might say no. there might not be enough black designers. Well, you know what? As a program organizer, it's your job to go and find them no matter what. And if they don't feel comfortable speaking, you coach them. I mean, really, she made me realize that it's very important. What is that? I think it's your fault.
Yeah, it's my fault.
It's your fault, my dear.
I see what you mean. It's like journalists highlighting only the work of men.
No, I don't think you do that. I think you've had your at least one of the women designers that you mentioned told you no, and I know that she's really a curmudgeon. No, but you know what I do very simply when people ask me for designers, I don't even say anything. I give 6 suggestions, 5 are women. I don't even say anything. You know, you can notice it or not. I just am trying to reestablish a certain balance and of diversity of all kinds. We're also responsible for not having enough political diversity. Like, for instance, I remember once I had a conversation with my colleagues because we never have anybody conservative or from the right at MoMA. You know what? We should start inviting them, you know, and have them speak, even though we might cringe inside. You know, it's important to have, especially today when it's so easy to fall in your own tribe, in your own group, and just, you know, have on your iPad all of the news that only come from certain sources. It's so important to diversify your landscape and your horizon.
I mean, this might sound, you know, this might be not a great question, but do you think women bring something particular to design that men can't?
Well, I think they bring something special to that men can't to everything, you know, so it's not only to design. There was an exhibition right now in Milan for the Salone that was about women in design that was
cringeworthy.
So, oh my God, it was like based on the cliches of the organicism, the flowers, etc. I'm not talking about that, but women are not the same as men. And the world has been a big men's club for centuries. So I'm sure that a predominance of women would change things for the better or for the worse. I have a feeling for the better, but at least it would change. If for anything, just because it would be a departure.
I mean, it's interesting for you as a woman to be in such an important position in this field. I mean, one of the most important positions in the world.
Yes, definitely. But once again, if you look at the hierarchy of most museums, there are people that are female at my position, but very few female that are directors or that are really in the highest positions. That's why we're also excited by the fact that Anne Pasternak became the director of the Brooklyn Museum and hired Nancy Spector to be the chief of, you know, it's not as frequent and as normal as one would think.
Let's talk a little bit about the 3D gun, a sentence that you had said that prior to that, the creation of the interesting divergence from women to 3D guns.
Sure.
Why not? you had said prior to that that you had thought that you had seen design as benign.
Yeah,
it was really a little naive.
Well, yeah, I just had, in Italy we say I had the paraocchi, you know, when you put those kind of shades on
blinders.
Horses, blinders. Yeah, I had blinders on. And I mean, you hear me when I talk about design, I'm so gung-ho and so, you know, in this kind of evangelical propaganda that I forced myself into this excessively positivistic view of design, and I didn't even think. And that's why it was such a big moment of revelation, because I really was like, oh my God, 3D printing, you can do something mean with it. And then all of a sudden, I started looking at things from a completely different viewpoint, and I started seeing how design can go bad, you know, it can happen, or it can be designed that way. You know, many product designers face a dilemma of sorts when they work for big companies, but that's one of the slightest moral dilemmas. There are much deeper ones that happen when you design objects that actually can be seen from both viewpoints. Ambiguity was the most important ingredient of Design and Violence, which is the project that was sparked by this 3D printed gun. Mm-hmm. So it's not about seeing the world black or white, evil or good. It's what can be taken from both sides that is really subtle and important.
So it sounds like there was an element of surprise there for you, that you had suddenly, you were surprised yourself that design could be, could actually not be benign.
No, I was more surprised by my naivete in thinking that it was only benign. You know, I was surprised by how...
By yourself.
Yeah. It was so limited. And that's when I think I embraced ambiguity and ambivalence. Right now I'm working on this theory of quantum design, because I'm trying to really work on this idea of ambivalence and how it's reflected in how we design.
Interesting. Let's just talk about surprise, though, for a moment. Are there, when I say what exhibition of yours that you've put together really surprised you?
The biggest surprise was Designing the Elastic Mind, which is an exhibition that I organized in 2008. The reason why it was a surprise, it's because I realized how a slight insecurity or vulnerability can be a boon for an exhibition, can be an advantage. You know, people think of MoMA shows as canonical shows that reveal the truth to the world. This is how Matisse is. This is what Dada is. Mm-hmm. This is it. And instead, Designing the Elastic Mind was an exhibition that was more about a what if. What if scientists and designers could work together without any filters or membranes between them? What if designers could help scientists hypothesize a future world, even if the experiment cannot be reproduced? So it was all... And so until like 2-3 days before the exhibition opened, I really could not sleep at night. I was scared that it would be a complete flop, that it would be risible. And then when it opened, it was a big success also because I had left the question open, and in a way I had asked people, what do you think? So when you leave dot, 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 people fill in and feel more engaged. And that's when I learned that it's always worth opening up the research from the beginning. Just a few weeks ago, 2 weeks ago, I organized a big program that launches an exhibition that will happen at the end of 2017. And I said openly, it's an exhibition about fashion. The last time MoMA did a show about fashion was 72 years ago.
Wow.
I don't know about fashion. I know a lot about design. So you know what? I'm going to show you what a curator that is ignorant of fashion does when she has to put together an exhibition in a year and a half. You know, so, all right, I'm here naked. Let's do it together. So it's much more fun for me. It creates generosity and a sense of participation. And in the end, the exhibition will be something that people will already be familiar with. It's almost like a single from a new LP release that is released before. Mm-hmm. You know, so mm-hmm. people become familiar with the music. So I don't know. I think it's a good way to go.
I just about fashion earlier when you were talking about the relationship between the designer and the maker. You know, the person, the manufacturer. I thought a lot about fashion because fashion designers design these beautiful dresses and then the seamstresses really actually make them. And mm-hmm. they are the ones that, you know, I don't know if they're unsung heroes. They possibly are quite sung. But it made me think about fashion at that time.
Well, some of them are sung. Others are destroyed by buildings that fall on their heads.
That's right.
So that's truly what the exhibition is about. And, in the program that we did 2 weeks ago, it was an abecedarium. So we had 26 vignettes, 7 minutes each, either narrated by a person or depended. R was for Rana Plaza, which is the building in Bangladesh that killed more than 2,000 people. I think it's very important to be aware of what's going on behind the objects, the labor issues, the manufacturing, the crafts, the technique, the skills. And that's pretty much the design knowledge that we can bring to the table. You know, fashion people talk about labor issues, but not as much or as comfortably as they should, because, you know, they are in that field. So our coming from the outside allows us to tackle also topics related to fashion that are not that comfortable.
The acquiring of the at symbol and the map, Google Maps dot, and ways in which we interact with, not interactive design, but the ways in which we interface with a website, all these things that you can acquire now, just changes the way a design museum is viewed and seen. What do you think is the future for design museums and design acquisition?
Well, paradoxically, people might not think about it, but it's much harder to acquire digital artifacts than to acquire physical artifacts. And code is very fragile. I like to say that it's almost more fragile than porcelain. So in the background of the museum, there will be so much work going on just for conservators and curators to figure out how to acquire code and how to show and display code. But on the front of the house, what people will see is an environment that is much more similar to the environment they really live in, which is an environment that is both physical and digital. This morning I went to see a demo of a virtual reality tool that is being used by a designer that was part of an exhibition I did in the past. And virtual reality tools are becoming more and more comfortable.
You brought up the word code a few times. And, you know, I live in San Francisco, and coders love to speak about themselves as sometimes even like they're craftspeople, they're designers. Is it a design? Are they designing?
Yeah, definitely. I've been trying to understand as a complete ignoramus what this holy grail that they have of the beauty of code is, you know, because I haven't gotten to it yet. But, you know, there's also a school here in New York called the School for Poetic Computation. I mean, really, coders consider themselves composers, poets. You know, yeah. The idea of comparing it to poetry, I think, is the best. So there's beauty in synthesis. There's beauty in dryness. Sometimes there's beauty in flourishes. I think that the closest understanding of the concept that I've ever gotten to is a visualization by Ben Fry. Ben Fry is a wonderful visualization designer, and he visualized the code of Pac-Man by using certain, you know, the code is written, but then whenever there's images, he puts a different icon, and then he has these beautiful loops because so much of coding is reverting to code already written. So it shows you this incredible construction that happens mentally with code. But I would like to understand it at a deeper level. So, I mean, like everybody else, I have subscribed to Code Academy, and it's like going to the gym. I mean, it's worse than going to the gym. Subscribe to Code Academy and then you don't do it. But I would like to learn a little bit of coding so that I can understand it better.
Well, there's a big history in that for you, because you were the first person to do a website here at the moment.
Yeah, that's right. Oh, you've done your homework, yes. Oh, yeah, I learned HTML. I mean, I was taught HTML by a PhD student, you know, that now is a great digital artist. And she taught it to me. I used the budget that I had, which was $300, to take taxes at night. So she would teach me. And I coded the first website, which is so bad and rudimentary, but I did. Hey, it has the whole checklist of the first show from 95. So
amazing, 1995. Mm-hmm. Yep. That was very early days.
Well, yes, it was, but it was necessary. And it was very funny because nobody at MoMA knew what a website was and whether it was publications, communications, marketing. So I could fall through the cracks.
In something I read, you said something like, you don't like using the word mavericks.
Was it mavericks?
Maybe.
I don't know. I don't remember. I don't have a particular allergy. I have other word allergies that are stronger than mavericks. But what was I referring to? A particular context?
Just designers. There's certain. You said maybe mavericks isn't the best term to use, but these are the designers that are mavericks to me, or something like that.
And oh, yeah. Because people want to cast creativity into these weird corners as if mavericks were weirdos. But in truth, there are many mavericks, just like there are many superheroes. You know what I'm saying? So that's maybe I wanted to just normalize talent and design ingenuity. Maybe that's why I was reacting to it.
Well, I guess the reason I brought it up was because it sounds like you've just pushed so many boundaries. I mean, true maverick.
Yeah, maybe I just don't like the word, how it sounds. It's like utterly. I hate utterly as a word.
Yeah, what are the words?
No, utterly is my real, I can't stand it.
What's a word you love?
Word that I love? Interesting. Well, there's one word that I love in Italian that does not exist in English, meschino, which means a person that's small and like an kind of, you know, you understand,
like that.
Right? Yeah, so I guess I love that word. No, truly, designers are fantastic. When they're not that good, they can do better. And design is an amazing discipline. So the idea of expanding it just comes quite natural because the world has changed and design is about building the world, constructing the world, but the world now is also very digital, so of course you have to go there.
So I thought you were on sabbatical.
I was until like a few weeks ago. Okay. It was wonderful.
Because I'm looking at your calendar and it doesn't look like a sabbatical to me.
Well, even during the sabbatical, it was never, I mean, the sabbatical was like a staycation in the sense that I was not really traveling. I was working hard, but in a different way. So I was teaching in the fall. I was at Harvard teaching. And then I was writing, I was doing studio visits. I just didn't have that many meetings and I didn't have to come to Midtown. It's so funny. The idea of having lunch downtown on a work day feels so illicit and wonderful to this day. It's like the most exciting thing. I can have lunch in Chinatown. Wow.
That's great.
Yes.
It's the little things.
I know. Really.
That was Paola Antonelli, Senior Curator of Architecture and Design at the Museum of Modern Art. We spoke at our office at MoMA in New York. If you liked what you heard here, subscribe to Architecture's Design and Mind on iTunes, rate us, and please share widely. My name is Tanika Tenjin, and thank you for listening to Design and Mind, a production of Architectura Assembly.